This is a reading of Steiner's early lectures entitled The Christian Mystery. This is section 5.3, entitled The Lord's Prayer, given on February 4th, 1907, in Karlsruhe. The deep secrets of existence can be found everywhere in the formulas for prayer, wisdom verses, and so on. They have come down to us from the great religions. We must be clear that all the various religions have had prayer, that they naturally differ in certain ways. In some cases, prayer is more of a so-called meditation. On the other hand, Christianity and several other religions had genuine prayer as we know it today. The Eastern religions have meditations mainly. Meditation involves immersing oneself in a spiritual content in such a way that one unites with the spiritual divine ground of the world, or the spiritual content. Please understand this correctly. There are religions that provide their followers with forms of meditation, for example, certain prayer-like formulas, in which one is immersed and, in such immersion, feels a river of divine spiritual life flowing through the soul. The individual rises during such moments to the divine ground of the spiritual world. Those formulas, however, are primarily made up of thought. Essentially, Christian prayer is no different than this. Its content, however, is oriented more toward feeling. Christians are immersed more in a path of feeling in the divine being that flows through the world. We should not think that Christian prayer was always understood, or even can be understood, as it is so often today. There is a prayer that is fundamental to Christianity, in which Jesus Christ himself indicated as clearly as possible the mood needed by Christians while praying. That essential prayer is this: Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. Unquote. Let us look carefully at these words. To begin with, we are dealing with a genuine request, the cup's passing. But at the same time, there is complete surrender to the will of the divine spiritual. Quote, nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. Unquote. This mood, that we allow the will of the divine spiritual to work through us during prayer, that we seek nothing for ourselves, but allow God to will within us, must permeate our prayer as a basic background tone, if our prayer is to be Christian. In this way, it is clearly impossible to have an egoistic prayer. In fact, it is impossible to send God an egoistic prayer for other reasons. If it were possible, one person would pray for rain while the neighbor prays for sunshine. Both would be praying out of egoism. This also completely excludes a situation where two armies are prepared to face one another for war, each praying for victory. But when the prevailing mood is, quote, not my will, but rather your will, unquote, we can pray for anything, and our prayer is derived from the will of the divine spiritual. I would like to pray for this, but I leave it to the divine spiritual to decide whether or not it should come to me. This is the fundamental mood of Christian prayer, and from this perspective arose the most comprehensive, universal prayer in Christian tradition, the Lord's Prayer, which, according to Christian tradition, was taught by Jesus Christ himself. It is one of the deepest prayers found anywhere in the world. Today, we can no longer measure the entire depth of the Lord's Prayer as taught in the original language. Its thought content is so powerful, however, that it cannot in any way be reduced by any language. If you look at the prayers of other peoples and nations where religions are in full blossom, those that have reached their peak, you will find prayers such as I have characterized. But once these various religions have descended from their highest development, their prayers assume a character that is less correct. They become magic formulas and means of idol worship. When Jesus taught his disciples how to pray, there were many such magic formulas in use, all of which were, of course, profoundly significant when they first came into existence. Such formulas always related to something external that an individual desired. They were concerned with a request filled with egoistic personal wishes. The Lord taught that Christians should not pray in that way. That is a prayer tied to something external, A Christian should pray in a, quote, quiet chamber, unquote, which is the innermost part of the human soul, the place where the human being can unite with the divine spiritual being. We must be clear that there is something living in every human being that may be characterized as a drop from the ocean of the divine. There is something in every human being that is like God. But it would be entirely wrong to think that any human being is therefore equal to God. When it is said that there is something in the human being like God, this does not mean that we are equal to God, for a drop from the ocean in its substance is like the ocean, but the drop is in no way the ocean itself. The human soul is a drop from the ocean of divinity, but it is not God. Just as a drop with its own substance can unite with the ocean when poured into it, so can the soul unite as a drop of God with God in a spiritual way through prayer or meditation. Jesus Christ calls this union of the soul with its God prayer in a quiet chamber. Now that we have characterized the attitude needed for Christian prayer, we can place the content of the Lord's Prayer itself before our souls. You are told that the Lord's Prayer is the most comprehensive prayer. For this reason, in order to understand the prayer, we find it is necessary to begin with a very comprehensive consideration of the world. We will need to follow a wide, indirect path to understand the Lord's Prayer. From a certain perspective, we must consider the essence of the human being. You know that we consider the human being just as spiritual research has for millennia. Let us once again quickly present this image to our souls. First of all, when someone stands before us, the physical body is there. In its material and forces, a human being has the physical body in common with all minerals and seemingly lifeless consequences of nature. But this physical body is not alone with us in the room, as materialism might lead us to believe. Rather, it is the lowest member of the human being. As the next member, we distinguish the etheric or life body of human beings, which we have in common with plants and animals. Every plant, every animal, and every human being must invoke chemical and physical substances so that they come to life. They cannot give life to themselves. The third member is the astral body, the bearer of pleasure and suffering, instincts, desires, passions, and the normal thoughts and mental images of ordinary life. Human beings could not have any of that without an astral body. This they have in common only with animals. Animals also feel pleasure and suffering, drives, desires, and passions, and they also have this body. Accordingly, human beings have their physical body in common with seemingly lifeless minerals, the etheric or life body in common with all that grows and reproduces, the entire plant kingdom, the astral body in common with animal nature. But human beings have something that lifts them above these three kingdoms of nature, something that makes them the crown of earthly creation. This is the fourth member of their being. We arrive at this member when we consider this. There is a name that is distinguished from all others. You can say capital I to no one but yourself. To everyone else I am you, and all others are you to me. As the name for what it signifies, the word I can be spoken only in the soul itself. It can never be spoken for the soul externally and indicate the one spoken to. The deeper religions have always felt this, and thus they have said that when the soul begins to give itself this self-designation within, God has begun to speak within the human being, the God who speaks through the soul. The name I cannot be spoken into the soul. It must be spoken out of the soul. This is the fourth member of the human being. Hebrew esoteric wisdom called I the unspeakable name of God. Yahweh simply means I am. No matter what ordinary scholarship may give as other interpretations, in fact it meant I am, the fourth member of the human being. The human being is made up, to begin with, of these four members. We also call them the four members of the so-called lower nature of the human being. To understand the whole human being, you must now go back a little in human evolution. We arrive back at the many various peoples who preceded us, the ancient Germanic and Middle European peoples, the Greeks and Romans, the Chaldeans, Egyptians, Assyrians, Babylonians, Hebrews, the Persian peoples, down to the people from which our present culture has emerged. But that culture also had predecessors, who lived somewhere else entirely indeed on the part of the earth, that now forms the seafloor between Europe and America, Atlantis. That continent was washed away by tremendous floods. The ground sank through a powerful event of nature, which has been preserved in the myths and legends of all nations as the flood. Even this, however, is not the oldest land of culture on earth. If we go farther back to the area where human beings arose in their present form, we find a land approximately between what is now Southeast Asia, Australia, and Africa, ancient Lemuria. Conditions then prevailed on earth that were entirely different than they are today. Usually we cannot imagine how great and all-encompassing the changes have been on earth, even during the course of human development. We encounter a time when the lower nature of the human being was present. There were beings on the earth at that time who consisted of four members: physical, etheric, astral, bodies, and I-being. Although those beings were more highly organized than the highest animals of today, they were not yet human beings. They were, quote, animal human beings, unquote, though not at all like today's animals. Modern animals are degenerated descendants that developed from the animal human beings by lagging behind and slipping backward in their development. Something very special happened to the beings who lived at that time. They were mature enough at that time to receive a certain power into themselves, a power that is our higher power of soul. At that time, the union of the human being's lower nature with the human soul took place. This human soul rested until then in the womb of God. It was a part of the Godhead itself. Above, in the kingdom of the spiritual, we have the divine spiritual being. Below, the fourfold human sheaths that had matured to this point and were capable of receiving drops of the Godhead. We can imagine what occurred at that time. Think of a glass of water, then take 100 little sponges, and with each absorb a drop of water one at a time. You then have 100 drops that were previously united completely with the water, now divided between 100 sponges. This serves as a simple image of the ensouling process. Until that time, souls rested in the great universal divine being, like drops in a glass of water. The physical human sheaths worked the same as these little sponges. These spiritual drops were separated from the universal divine substance. They were individualized as soul drops in sheaths, and began to create human beings as they are now, as spiritual physical beings. Those souls incarnated then for the first time, and have passed since then through many, many incarnations, creating and shaping the human body into its present form. What happened at that time was the union of parts of the Godhead with the lower members of the human being. They have advanced with every incarnation and become more perfect, in order to achieve a kind of culmination in the future. This aspect of our higher nature united with us then as a force that can change the lower nature, elevating itself in the transformation. We call it the higher essence of the human being, spirit self, life spirit, and spirit body. Footnote: Geistesmensch, literally spirit human being, or Atman, has been rendered spirit body in Steiner's Theosophy, whereas in the past it has been translated as spirit man, since Mensch, or human being, is often translated as man. Geistesmensch refers the part of the physical body that has been entirely transformed into a spiritual body, and thus provides the basis for the human being's existence as a human spiritual being when the material earth no longer exists. In Sanskrit, the term Atman means divine. End of footnote. Other terms for these members are manas, buddhi, and atman. Those are the parts of divine being through which human beings gradually transform their lower nature, step by step, into a higher nature. Through their power of manas, they transform the astral body, through buddhi, the etheric body, and through the power of atman, the physical body. All these members must be clarified, spiritualized for human beings to one day reach the goal of their evolution. At one time we had the four members, physical, etheric, astral bodies, and I-being. Then during Lemuria we received the seeds of higher development that we're actually an emanation of the highest spiritual human being, the threefold higher nature of the human being, the divine essence, the divine disposition of the human being. We can consider this higher part of our human nature from two points of view. One is to say, quote, this is the essence of the higher human being, to which human beings must develop themselves in the course of evolution, unquote. Or we can see it as part of the divine being from which it has emanated, the divine part of the human being. A Christian would, to begin with, consider it in the former sense, and we wish to do this as well, and to study the nature of these higher forces in the human being. We will begin with the highest member, with what is called the power of Atman in the human being. What I now describe is not any kind of a definition, but instead I would like to characterize for you the real nature and being of this higher part of human nature. What becomes the power of Atman, inasmuch as it is a force coming from the Godhead, has the nature of will. If you think about your own power to will, what it is within you that actually does the willing, then you have a shadowy reflection of what flows from the power of Atman, from God. The human will is the force in us today that is least developed. However, the will can be developed further and further, until a time comes when it reaches a kind of culmination, and is then capable of carrying out what is called in religion the great sacrifice. Imagine standing before a mirror and looking into it. Your reflection is completely identical to you in every part of your physiognomy, your gestures, in everything. It is exactly like you, but it is a dead reflection of you. As a living being, you stand before your dead reflection, which resembles you in every way, except that you are a living being with substantial content. Imagine yourself at a time when your will has grown to the point that it can resolve to give up your existence, your own being, and to give it to your reflection in the mirror. You would be in a position to sacrifice yourself completely and bestow your life upon your mirrored reflection. This is the highest development of the will, or, quote, the divine will of the Father, unquote. Of all the powers of the soul today, the human will is the least developed. But it is on the way to developing such might and power that it can perform the great sacrifice. This is the true nature of what can evolve out of the power of Atman, the power of will to the degree that it flows from the being of God. Let us consider the second member of the human being's higher nature, Buddhi, or in Christian terms, life spirit, as an emanation from God. You can get an idea of this most readily by thinking not of the power that flows forth to enliven the mirrored reflection, but rather of the mirrored image itself. A complete duplication of the original being appears in the mirrored image. It is the same, and yet not the same. If you apply this to the world, to the entire universe, the divine will of the world is mirrored in a point toward all sides. Think of a hollow sphere that reflects inward. A single point within will be reflected inward endlessly. Everywhere is endless diversification, the divine will of the world reflected in mirrored images, details of the divine. The cosmos or universe may be viewed as a reflection of the endless will of the world. The divine will of the world does not belong to any individual being. Rather, the world will is mirrored everywhere in the most manifold and diverse ways. In the Christian sense of the term kingdom, kingdom refers to the mirroring of the Godhead, whereby the Godhead remains in place and yet enlivens every point in which it is reflected by the great sacrifice. The term kingdom signifies what in the human being is Buddhi. If you look at the universe in relation to the creative, productive principle that flows from the original divine source, then it is this that initially connects to Atman, its divine spark of life, Buddhi. As the kingdom, it is universal cosmic. Let us now look at the details of the kingdom. First, we considered it in its wholeness. Now we will consider the individual parts. How do we distinguish one from another? We do this by means of what is called, in the Christian sense, name. Everything is named, and thus we can distinguish the manifold details of the kingdom. A Christian understands the name to mean what is often called an idea, are what belongs to a thing. Just as an individual human being is distinguished from another, so we also experience the name. In the name and in each thing, part of the divinely mirrored being is to be found. Christians relate properly to this name when they are clear that every single member of the kingdom has emanated from the divine, that every bite of bread is an emanation, a mirror, and a part of the Godhead. A Christian should clearly understand that this is true for the smallest thing. In human nature, the individual spirit self is responsible for the fact that a person has individuality in relationship to others. What exists in the kingdom as the name, the individual human being has in the individual spirit self, or manas, since a person constitutes a particular part of the Godhead and has a particular name, a name that accompanies an individual human being through all incarnations. We see this threefold nature now as an emanation from the divine spiritual being. Atman is the will of the Godhead. Buddhi, or life spirit, is the kingdom. And Manas, or spirit self, is the name. Now let us look at the four lower parts of the human being, beginning from below with the physical body. This body has the same substances and forces as external physical nature, and is constantly, quote-unquote, turning over these substances and forces. They enter into and then leave the human physical body. The human being is only present because these substances and forces are constantly entering and leaving. Human beings can exist only because they continually renew themselves with external physical substances. They form a wholeness with the rest of physical nature. You can no more cut off your finger and have it remain what it is, then you can separate the human physical body from the earthly and have it remain what it is. Your finger would dry up as soon as it was separated from the rest of your body. It is what it is only because it is part of the whole organism. So too, human beings are connected with the elements of the earth. Physical substances and forces flow in and out of human beings. These substances make it possible for human beings to maintain their being. The second member is the etheric life body. We must understand that the life body is what calls to life merely physical substances and forces. It bears our growth and reproduction and the appearances of life altogether. But it also supports something entirely different, all the characteristics of the human being that are more enduring than our transient urges, desires, and passions. To understand these distinctions, recall when you were 8 years old. Think of all you have learned since then and the many thoughts, images, and experiences that have enriched your soul. It is an enormous amount. Now consider how slowly something else changes. Think of how you were a hot-tempered child and ask yourself if this temper does not sometimes still break through since your inclinations and temperament have largely remained the same. What we learn and experience can be compared to the minute hand on a clock, while changes in our character, temperament, and habits can be compared to the hour hand of a clock. This great difference exists because the astral body carries what we learn and experience, whereas the etheric body carries one's temperament. A change in habit means a change in one's etheric body. If you merely learned this or that, then your astral body has changed. Learning is not the basis for training someone who is becoming a disciple, in the higher sense of genuine esotericism. Rather, all learning of esoteric science occurs within the etheric body. Consequently, if you have managed to transform any firmly rooted characteristic, you have done more for a true esoteric training than you would by acquiring any amount of external knowledge. Accordingly, the distinction is made exoterically for what the etheric body carries and esoterically for what the human body, for what the etheric body requires. The etheric body also carries memory as a characteristic. For example, a change in the etheric body is connected with the memory becoming sharper. Or, if the memory is diminished, that also means a change in the etheric body, a change in the power of memory. There is something else that is very important to us. Because of the way human beings are today, we live in two directions. We all belong to a family, a tribe, an ethnic group, and so on. There are certain characteristics that we have in common with others, which connect us to them. The French tend to have different characteristics from Germans, who in turn have attributes that are different from the English. Those within each group have certain ethnic traits in common. Additionally, they each have individual characteristics, thus going beyond the ethnic group, which makes each a unique human being. We belong to a community as a result of certain characteristics of the etheric body. The etheric body has characteristics through which we belong to an ethnic group, a race, and all of us together to the human race. If we wish to understand what leads us to grow beyond this community, we must look at the astral body, which determines what is individual in each human being. Individual life within community depends, therefore, on an individual's etheric body finding its proper balance in relation to the etheric bodies of those with whom that person must live. If such a balance is not found, one cannot live together with those others. It simply does not work. The individual falls out of community. Thus, the human etheric body is the task of fitting in with other etheric bodies. The astral body determines what is individual in the human being. Above all, the astral body should live so that the human being does not commit personal sins. When the astral body goes astray here or there, we sin personally. The astral body strays. Disharmony with one's community is a mistake, or lapse of the etheric body. When spoken precisely, Christian esotericism called the errors of the etheric body guilt, or the cause of our disturbances with others. Christian esotericism refers to a lapse of the astral body, which is determined by the individual as being, quote, overcome by temptation, unquote. In terms of drives, passions, and desires, the astral body succumbs to temptation. It strays by falling into the temptation within itself. Christian esotericism made this distinction between guilt and falling into temptation. Then there is the fourth member of the human being, the I. We have discussed the physical body, which exists through metabolism, the etheric body, which can be afflicted with guilt, and the astral body, which can be overpowered by temptation. And then there is the I, the original foundation for self-seeking egoism. The I caused what was one within the great divine spiritual being to move outward into the many. The descent from the unity of the divine into individuals was conditioned by the I. This is why Christian Gnosis saw the I as the true origin of egoism and self-seeking. As long as individual beings were united in the Godhead, they could not strive against one another. They could do this only in their separation as individual I beings. Formerly, their desire could only be that of the Godhead. Christianity calls this development of self through opposition to others, quote, which corresponds to egoism, parenthesis, the, quote, error of the I, unquote. And Christian tradition can state the exact time when the soul descended into the body through the fall into sin, the moment the apple was bitten. The actual error of the I is characterized by the expression evil. The error of the fourth member then is evil. Only the I being can fall into evil. And this came about through what is characterized as the apple bite. In the Latin language, malum refers to both apple and evil. To summarize briefly, the physical body is the same as the physical elements surrounding it, and maintains itself through constant interchange of matter and forces, or metabolism. The etheric body maintains a balance with other members of a community, which can incur guilt. There is also the astral body, which should avoid yielding to temptation, and the I, which must not be allowed to become the victim of egoism or evil. This fourfold being unites with the higher threefold nature, the divine kernel of the human being, will, Atman, kingdom, Buddhi, and name, Manas. Now think of prayer for a moment as a union of the human being in the quiet chamber with the Godhead itself. In the most basic understanding of Christianity, the soul is portrayed as divine, as a drop from the ocean of God. And this soul must plead that this isolated drop might return again one day to its origin. This origin of the human being's divinity is signified by the Father name. And what the soul strives after, The place where it will again be united with what is called the Father name is Devakan, or heaven. Now let us think about the primal prayer, an individual human being calling out to the Divine Father Essence. This prayer had to plead that the three higher members of the human being might evolve, that the will, which is the highest emanation of the divine, be realized in the human being, that the second member of the divine being, the kingdom, take hold in the human being, and that the third member, the name, be experienced as holy. These relate to the three higher members of the divine being within the human being. And for the four lower members of the human being, we would ask, quote, "May my physical body receive what it needs for sustenance. May my etheric body find a balance between its own guilt and that of others. May it live in harmony with others," unquote. The prayer would have to plead on behalf of the astral body that no temptation pull it down, and on behalf of the eye that it not succumb to evil, whose actual emanation is referred to as egoism. You should plead for your uniting with the Father in an archetypal prayer. You should do this in such a way that the individual members of your sevenfold being stand before your soul in your prayer. Quote, "Our Father in the heavens," unquote. First, call the Father. Then bring your requests that relate to the three higher members. Quote, "Your name be hallowed, your kingdom come, your will be done as in heaven, so also on earth," unquote. Then there are four requests related to the four other members of the human being. Quote, "Give us today our daily bread," and "Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors," unquote. This is the balance with those among whom we live. Quote, "And lead us not into temptation," unquote, refers to our astral body. Quote, "But deliver us from the evil," unquote, that is, from emanating any egoism. We have in the seven petitions of the Lord's Prayer, therefore, the meaning of the development of our sevenfold nature. The Lord's Prayer as a Christian prayer was given from deep wisdom concerning the human being. We need only to understand it, and then we have all the theosophical wisdom that concerns the human being. All prayers created from the deepest wisdom are effective for millennia, not just for brief periods of time. They are prayers that take hold of souls and lift up hearts. Such a prayer has never been provided by assembling beautiful and sublime words arbitrarily. Rather is it derived from the deepest wisdom, for only then would it have the power to exert an influence on human souls throughout thousands of years. You cannot argue that a naive soul knows nothing of such wisdom. Such knowledge is unnecessary, since the power contained in the Lord's Prayer comes from this wisdom in any case, and works even if we know nothing of it. We must understand this correctly. Anyone can approach a plant and be delighted by it. Even the most naive soul can be delighted, and perhaps know nothing of the divine wisdom within the plant. It is exactly the same with great prayers. We need no more knowledge about the wisdom contained in such a prayer. Nevertheless, the holiness of the prayer has the force, the wisdom, the power to elevate. If it was born out of the highest wisdom, then it does not matter if we know about that wisdom. It matters only that we experience the power of the wisdom. In our age, it is possible for the first time to evoke from the prayer what Jesus Christ put into it, and to know the power he placed particularly into the Lord's Prayer. Because it was drawn from the greatest depths of wisdom concerning the human being, concerning our sevenfold being, for this reason it is great and powerful even for the most naive soul, and truly uplifting for a soul able to extract the wisdom contained within it. And it loses nothing of the power that it has always exerted, deeply moving and elevating, when we know that all of theosophy, parenthesis, or wisdom of the divine, parenthesis, is there within the Lord's Prayer. The Lord said much to the public in parables, but when he was alone with his disciples, he explained those parables, since it was intended that the disciples receive the wisdom-filled explanation of the parables, and through their power become his apostles and messengers. Through them they could understand him, and from them he himself received the magical forces that have caused his work to continue to be effective throughout the millennia. This should lead us into the meaning of the Lord's Prayer. The end of section 5.3, or lecture, in a sense. Yeah, section.